Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast of the Trust and Estate section of the California Lawyers Association. I'm Anna Solomon, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, we'll be diving into the exciting world of fiduciary income tax. This episode is entitled Trust Income Taxation 101. We have a very special guest today, Michael DiBernardo, who is a CPA, Certified Public Accountant, and partner at Almond DiBernardo & Associates. Hi, Michael. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, certainly. So as you mentioned, I'm a partner at Almond DiBernardo & Associates. We're an accounting firm in Manhattan Beach, California. And we specialize in serving the needs of high net worth individuals and their families. So we do a lot of work around the trust and estate tax world.
Great. And again, thank you for joining us. And, you know, I was specifically asked to do an episode about the basics of fiduciary income tax or income tax returns for trust and estates. In the trust and estates community, we have a lot of practitioners who don't have to deal with income tax on a daily basis. So this episode is really geared towards them. It's meant to be just a general and practical overview of fiduciary income tax for people who want to either learn the basics or they need a refresher. And Michael, I'm confident that you can very much simplify this area of the law for us. So let's just get started.
Sounds good.
Great. So as you know, trusts and estates are its own separate entity. And just like any other individual or entity, the trustee of the trust or representative of the estate often have to file tax returns. Now, Michael, my very first basic question to you is, when does a trustee of a trust or representative of an estate need to file an income tax return?
Yeah, so the statutory rule is whenever the trust or estate has $600 in gross income or if there is a non-resident beneficiary. However, even though that's the statutory rule, we generally recommend to all of our trustees that they should file an income tax return even if they aren't required to. And the reason that we recommend that is because we want to start tolling the statute of limitations on audits. And for the IRS, that statute of limitation is 3 years from the date of filing the return. And in California, that statute of limitation is 4 years from the date of filing a return. So if a return is never filed, then technically the statute doesn't toll.
And that seems just like a very low threshold for filing. Now, what is the highest federal tax rate for trusts? And how about in California? What's the highest rate?
So the highest federal tax rate for trusts is 37%, and that's on ordinary income. And in California, it could go up to 13.3%. So there are really three different types of taxes that the trust would need to contend with. One is the ordinary rates, and that's where it could get up to the 37% federal, 13.3% California. And then the other is the capital gains rates. Capital gains rates can go up to 20% at the federal level. And for California, we don't have a separate capital gains rate schedule. So it could also go up to 13.3%.
Wow. So that's a lot of tax.
A lot of tax. And there's still one more on top of that, and that's the net investment income tax, which is an additional 3.8%. So on capital gains types of taxes, you could be looking at 23.8% federal at the high end, plus 13.3% California on the high end. And that 13.3% kicks in California above $1 million. Otherwise, the top tax rate would be 12.3%, which is still high.
Yeah, that's very, very high. So as we're talking about basics, I think that it's also important to talk about grantor trusts versus non-grantor trusts. Now, irrevocable trusts that have certain powers in them can be a grantor trust, and revocable trusts, while the grantor is alive, are also grantor trusts. Now, Mike, can you tell us the difference between a grantor trust and a non-grantor trust? How are they treated differently from an income tax perspective?
Yeah, certainly. So as you mentioned, a grantor trust is a trust where the grantor retains certain powers over the trust such that the income of the trust is still taxable to the grantor. So in the case of a grantor trust, the taxation would be treated very much as if the grantor had owned the asset themselves. So they would report it on their own income tax return in the same manner that they would if they had not put the asset into the trust. As for a non-grantor trust, the trust is treated as a separate tax entity and would file its own tax return as if it had owned the asset and had, would be paying tax on the asset.
So it would have to file its own 1041. So grantor trust, it would be on the grantor's 1040. And for a non-grantor trust, it would be on the trust's separate form 1041. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And, you know, I've also heard of trustees who, even though they have a, they're trustee of a grantor trust, they obtain a separate EIN for the grantor trust and then file a, because now the IRS knows about this trust since it applied for an EIN, files a pretty much a blank 1041 with the new EIN. And they just have a statement on it that says, all of the income that the trust earned is reported on the grantor's 1040. Now, this seems like, you know, a few extra steps here. Do you have any thoughts on that and why somebody would do it that way?
Yeah, I agree. It is an extra step to file the blank 1041, even for a grantor trust. Generally, we don't see that. Generally, what we see is that the 1041 is not filed for a grantor trust. However, it depends on the trustee. And the reason that I would see someone file a blank 1041 is that technically grantor trusts are supposed to file 1041s. However, there are certain alternative methods that are more commonly used, and that's why we don't see the return filed separately. Where we would normally see a grantor trust file a return is if the trustee was not the initial grantor. And so it just kind of goes back to that need to toll the statute of limitations for the trustee and the trustee possibly wanting to protect themselves. But in the case of a grantor trust, like a living trust, we generally don't see the separate 1041 filed because the grantor and the trustee are generally the same person.
Yeah, I think I would echo that. In my practice, we don't really see the separate 1041, but sometimes you do. So just wanted to bring that up. So let's talk about when trust and estates practitioners would encounter a grantor trust versus a non-grantor trust. So as a California practitioner, revocable trusts are pretty much a basic part of every estate plan. And as I'd mentioned before, revocable trusts during the trustor's lifetime are grantor trusts. So let's say a person funds their revocable trust. And as we stated, the income from those assets are reported on the trustor's income tax return. Now the trustor passes away. As drafted, a typical revocable trust becomes irrevocable once the grantor passes away, and now it's a non-grantor trust. So at that point, Michael, does the trust that's now a non-grantor trust need to obtain its own EIN and file its own return? Of course, given that it meets the income threshold. Is that correct? And is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, that's correct. So generally when the trust becomes irrevocable and becomes a non-grantor trust, it should file its own return. And the important thing to keep in mind is that the due date of the 1041 return is April 15th. And then there's also an extended due date available up to September 30th. So it's important to keep in mind because the extended due date for trust is not the full 6 months that you get with the individual. So if you're working with someone who has deceased, their individual return on extension may have until October 15th, but you have to file that trust return by September 30th if you had the extension in place.
That's a really good point. Thank you for bringing that up. It's pretty straightforward for a single person when they fund a revocable trust. Now let's talk about a married couple. So let's say a married couple funds a revocable trust. And again, typically in California, when one spouse dies, that one revocable trust now divides into two, maybe even three different trusts after the first spouse passes away. So usually one of the newly created trusts, which is often called the survivor's trust, and that contains the surviving spouse's property, their half of the community and their separate property, that remains revocable. And the survivor continues to be the grantor of the trust and it's a grantor trust. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then the other trust or trusts, either called the exemption trust or marital trust, depending on how the trust is drafted, those trusts contain the deceased spouse's property, and those become irrevocable, and they're now non-grantor trusts. Is that correct?
That's correct as well.
So in that case, what returns would have to be filed?
Yeah, so in that case, you would now have the 1040 return for the spouse that has survived. And then you would also have a 1041 for the trusts that are non-grantor trusts. And you could even have a situation where those non-grantor trusts have an income beneficiary that is the surviving spouse. And so that surviving spouse may receive a K-1 from one of those non-grantor trusts. So even if the spouse is still receiving the benefit of the trust that has become non-grantor, that spouse could still be taxed on the income from it. But you would have to file the separate return, even though that is almost similar to the way the grantor trust is treated with the income tax being paid by the spouse. You still have to have that separate return filed.
And how about in the situation where a couple jointly funds, let's say, an irrevocable gift trust during life? Now, what happens when one of the spouses dies?
A lot of times what we see with the irrevocable gift trusts is those could be grantor trusts as well, and that's a way of increasing the gift that you're providing to the children or whoever the beneficiaries are without really eating away at your lifetime exemption. So a lot of times we see that those are grantor trusts, and those can become non-grantor at the time of one of the spouse's passings. So it's really important to file that 1041 for that type of trust, and also keep in mind that with the irrevocable gift trust, when both spouses were alive, you had the benefit of being able to make use of each spouse's annual exclusion. Whereas now, going forward, you'd only have the one $15,000 annual exclusion.
So for gift tax purposes.
Yeah, for gift tax purposes.
Right. So when you gift assets into the irrevocable trust. And, you know, I want to go back to a point that you made for gift trust, how it's an added benefit for it to be a grantor trust. So what you mean by that is because the grantor pays the taxes for the trust, when the grantor pays the taxes, that doesn't count against any sort of gift tax. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's essentially a way of paying a liability that would otherwise be a liability of your beneficiaries without it actually counting either in the annual exclusion of the $15,000 or against your lifetime exclusion.
Let's get a little bit more specific here. And first, let's talk about income, and then we'll touch upon the treatment of capital gains. So when we talk about trust income, there are two terms that we should know. One is distributable net income, and the other is fiduciary accounting income. And this, at least for me, can be very confusing concepts. So can you explain that to us, the difference between DNI, distributable net income, and FAI, which is fiduciary accounting income?
Yeah, so I agree. It can get confusing. Fiduciary accounting income is the income that the grantor intends on being provided to the income beneficiaries, separate from what would be considered the principal beneficiaries who would not receive income from things like dividends, interest, and ordinary income. Those three categories are generally part of fiduciary accounting income and are allocated to the income beneficiaries. Capital gains generally are not part of fiduciary accounting income and are allocated to principal or the corpus of the trust. Distributable net income, on the other hand, is the net income that's going to be distributed out to the beneficiaries and taxed to the beneficiaries and not taxed to the trust. The difference between those two is primarily a timing difference, because you could have a situation where you have fiduciary accounting income that is not intended on being distributed in the current year, and so would not be distributable net income currently, and would not be taxable to the beneficiaries currently. So that's the primary difference between the two.
So my understanding is if income is distributed to a beneficiary, then the beneficiary will then receive a K-1 from the trust, and that's what the beneficiary would report on that person's tax return. Can you walk us through practically how that works? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So there's, in a situation where the income is distributed to the beneficiary would receive a K-1 based on the items of income that are distributed to that beneficiary. So typically what we would see would be ordinary income, dividends and interest on the K-1 if the income was distributed out to the beneficiary. We typically would not see capital gains even if there was a distribution in excess of the other items of income. So you can have a situation where your distribution exceeds the ordinary income, interest, and dividends, but that additional income to the beneficiary may not be a portion of those items. And so something like capital gains would not necessarily be included on the K-1 to the beneficiary unless it was specifically designed to be part of fiduciary accounting income when the trust was designed.
And strategically, when would you want to, I guess as trustee, distribute more income to a beneficiary? Of course, if the trust instrument allows for it.
Yeah, certainly. So one thing to keep in mind with the trust's tax rates compared to individual tax rates is trust tax rates are far more compressed than the individual rates. Individuals have 7 different tax brackets, whereas trusts only have 4. And trusts hit the top tax bracket much quicker than individuals do. Trusts will hit their top tax bracket of 37% at around $13,000 of income.
Wow.
Where for individuals, it'd have to be much higher to get to that level of tax. So you would prefer to distribute out more of the ordinary income to individuals to the extent allowable so that you can utilize more of those tax brackets.
So, you know, we've talked about the treatment of income, and let's talk about the treatment of capital gain. So again, back to the basics, capital gain is the profit you earn from the sale of property. So for example, let's say a trust owns a house, the house has a basis of $500,000, and the trustee sells the house for $1 million, therefore realizing $500,000 in capital gain. So you touched upon it a little bit, Michael, but in general, how is this capital gain going to be treated on a fiduciary income tax return?
Yeah, in general, if this was a non-grantor trust that had to file a 1041, the non-grantor trust would have to pay the tax on this capital gain of $500,000. And let's say the non-grantor trust were to distribute that income out to the beneficiary, the beneficiary would not necessarily receive that $500,000 on a K-1. Because it would still be taxed to the trust. This example with where we're looking at a house is a unique one because you could also have a situation where if we go back to the grantor trust, the sale of this house could qualify for the primary residence exclusion if the asset is still considered an asset of the grantor. So it would be different depending on if it's a grantor trust or non-grantor trust in this particular case. But if we were looking at capital gains in general more broadly, for a non-grantor trust, those capital gains would be taxed within the trust unless the grantor specifically defined capital gains as part of fiduciary accounting income. And those capital gains were pushed out.
Of course, that's sort of an oversimplification. Like, there's a lot of complicated rules, right, relating to capital gains.
Yeah.
So are there any that you want to just sort of highlight? I know we can't go through all of them, but any that you want to highlight when it comes to treatment of capital gains?
Yeah. So I would say that one of the more important things to highlight with capital gains with trusts, especially, I mean, we see this a lot in California. There are people with qualified small business stock. And so oftentimes they will make contributions of the qualified small business stock to non-grantor trusts and have to make it to a non-grantor trust. So that way they can get an extra $10 million exclusion on the gains of that qualified small business stock. That's one of the interesting rules is that even though you might think that you wouldn't get an extra exclusion for that, you would, and it's because the trust is considered a separate taxpayer.
Yeah, and a lot of clients actually have asked about that specific rule too. That's very popular right now, right?
Yeah.
And let's talk about other specific rules that we often encounter. What's the 65-day rule?
Yeah, so the 65-day rule is an election that you can make where you can distribute out income to income beneficiaries within 65 days after the end of the year and still take the distribution deduction on the trust's income tax return. So it's a nice way of...
For the prior year, right?
Yes, I'm sorry, for the prior year. Yes.
Yeah.
Within 65 days of year end, you can make a distribution and still take the distribution deduction on the prior year's return.
And practically speaking, like, why would anybody want to do that and take advantage of that election?
that kind of goes back to the income tax bracket arbitrage and trying to make sure that you distribute out as much of the ordinary income to the beneficiaries as possible to make use of the more elongated tax brackets of individuals compared to trusts. And another instance where we see this quite often is trusts that hold real estate, because oftentimes the books aren't closed by the end of the year and you need a little bit of time to do the bank reconciliations and make sure you've gotten everything recorded. So it is also a nice way of making sure that you have a little bit of extra time to make the distribution to beneficiaries that may be required by the trust documents.
And how does one make this election? How do we practically take advantage of this rule?
Yeah, so this one is a fairly simple election to make. We make it with the filing of the return, and we notate that the election has been made. The primary thing to make sure of is that the distribution is actually made by the 65th day.
Yeah, make sure that it actually goes out of the trust into the beneficiary's bank account. So let's talk about an election that relates to estates, the 645 election. And as we've discussed before, estates are like trusts. If an estate meets the filing threshold, then the representative of the estate also needs to file a 1041. So let's say you're administering both a trust and estate. So we have a client who has a revocable trust, that person dies. Now, our decedent didn't fully fund their revocable trust, which we see a lot in California, so that now the decedent's named executor in their will, they have to open probate. So the trustee and the executor, oftentimes they're the same person, now have to file two returns, one for the estate and one for the trust, unless they make a 645 election. Now, Michael, can you explain that election to us?
Yeah, certainly. So the 645 election is an election that's made on Form 8855. And it's an election that can be made by qualified revocable trusts, which are generally the grantor trusts that exist within the decedent's estate at the end of the year. The election must be made by the filing of the return, including extensions. And that election allows the trust to file its income tax return with the estate. And so rather than having two 1041s, you would have a single 1041.
And when does that election terminate? Like, are you allowed to forever file one return for the trust and estate? I mean, you assume that the estate closes at some point, right?
Yeah, so the election lasts for the later of 2 years or 6 months from the date of a final estate tax liability determination. So it could even extend beyond 2 years if you have an audit that's ongoing and the final determination of the estate tax liability hasn't been made. So unfortunately, it's not a permanent election. It does generally end within the 2 year period.
And why is it important to track when that election terminates?
Yeah, certainly. So you won't necessarily get a letter from the IRS informing you that the 2 year period has ended. And at the termination of the 2 years, the trust would now need to file its own 1041. So if you aren't keeping track of that, then you'll start to receive notices from the IRS that the trust is delinquent on filing its tax return. So it's really important for the practitioners to track that internally and make sure that they begin to file the returns once they're required and once the election terminates.
So again, another good tool to save you a tax return for a few years here.
Yeah, certainly.
So I think we have, you know, just a few more minutes, but let's just touch upon charitable trusts. Michael, is there anything about charitable trusts that you'd like to discuss?
Yeah, certainly. So there's two main types of charitable trusts. There's charitable remainder trusts and charitable lead trusts. We see charitable remainder trusts quite often with our clients because it's a great way to make donations to charitable organizations and receive a current year income tax deduction for the individual. So with a charitable remainder trust, that trust is a non-grantor trust, but it's treated as an exempt entity. So if you made a donation of appreciated property to a charitable remainder trust, you would receive the value that is equal to the present value of whatever the fair market value of the donation will ultimately be to charity. So if the donation to charity, if the term of the trust is, say, 10 years, you would need to calculate what the present value of that donation is 10 years from now. And that's the value that the individual will receive as a deduction. Charitable lead trusts are a little bit different. The charitable lead trusts are non-grantor trusts, but they are not exempt. So it's important to keep in mind that income within the charitable lead trusts would need to be taxed on that 1041. So those are, you know, the two main types of charitable trusts that we see. And another thing to keep in mind with the charitable remainder trusts, especially now after the SECURE Act has gotten rid of the stretch IRAs, you can actually use charitable remainder trust as a way of creating your own stretch IRA. You can make a contribution of the IRA to the charitable remainder trust once the person passes away, and you can extend out the term of that charitable remainder trust to be lifetime of whoever the non-charitable beneficiary would be. And that's a way of getting yourself a little bit of an extra time to make the distributions from the IRA.
That's a great point, Michael. Well, that's all the time that we have for this episode. Thank you again, Michael, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Michael has given us his contact information and a link to an article that he co-authored. So please take a look at the show notes to see how to contact our guests if you have any other questions. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Trust Me.
Trust Me is a production of the Trusts and Estate section of the California Lawyers Association and produced by Foley Mara Studios. For further information, please go to calawyers.org, click on Sections, Trusts and Estates, and look for the Education tab to learn about upcoming live programs, online CLE and webcasts, as well as a broad range of low-cost self-study programs. Many of our guests are contributors to the Trusts and Estates Quarterly, the official publication of the section. Benefits of membership include the quarterly, along with email case alerts and other opportunities to stay current in the Trusts and Estates field. Please consider subscribing to this podcast so that you don't miss our next episode. And thanks for listening to Trust Me.